Tosh. Here on Radio 4 FM, our new book of the week. The story of Maya Angelou's extraordinary life has been chronicled in her series of best-selling autobiographies. Now, finally, the legendary author shares the deepest personal story of her life, her relationship with her mother. Adjoa Ando reads Mom and Me and Mom.
The first decade of the 20th century was not a great time to be born black and poor and female in St. Louis, Missouri. But Vivian Baxter was born black and poor to black and poor parents. Later, she would grow up and be called beautiful. As a grown woman, she would be known as the butter-colored lady with the blowback hair. Her father, a Trinidadian with a heavy Caribbean accent, had jumped from a banana boat in Tampa, Florida, and evaded immigration agents successfully all his life. He spoke often and loudly with pride at being an American citizen. No one explained to him that simply wanting to be a citizen wasn't enough to make him one. Contrasting with her father's dark chocolate complexion, her mother was light-colored enough to pass for white. She was called an octoroon, meaning that she had 1/8 Negro blood. Vivian was the firstborn of the Baxter children. Her sister Leah was next, followed by four brothers. As they grew, their father made violence a part of their inheritance. He said often, "If you get into jail for theft or burglary, I'll let you rot. But if you're charged with fighting, I'll sell your mother to get your bail." The family became known as the Bad Baxters. If someone angered any of them, they'd track the offender to his saloon. The brothers, armed, would enter the bar. Uncle Cladwell would grab a wooden chair and break it, handing Vivian a piece. He would say, "Vivian, go kick that bastard's ass." Vivian would ask, "Which one?" When her brother said, "That's enough," the Baxter gang would gather their violence and quit the scene, leaving their mean reputation in the air. At home, they told their fighting stories often and with great relish. Grandmother Baxter played piano in the Baptist church, and she liked to hear her children sing spiritual gospel songs. The same rough Baxter men, led by their fierce older sister, would harmonize in the kitchen on "Jesus, Keep Me Near the Cross." They were proud to be loud and on key. Vivian's father always wanted to hear about the rough games his sons played, but if their games ended without at least a scuffle, he'd blow air through his teeth and say, "That's little boys play. Don't waste my time with silly tales." Then he would tell Vivian, "Bibi, these boys are too big to play little girls' games. Don't let them grow up to be women." Vivian took his instructions seriously. She promised her father she'd make sure they were tough. She led her brothers to the local park and made them watch as she climbed the highest tree. She picked fights with the toughest boys in her neighborhood. Her father told her, "Bibi, you are Papa's little girl boy. You won't have to be so tough forever. When Cladwell gets up some size, he'll take over." Vivian said, "If I let him." My mother, who was to remain a startling beauty, met my father, a handsome soldier, in 1924. Bailey Johnson had returned from World War I with officer's honors and a fake French accent. They were unable to restrain themselves. They fell in love while Vivian's brothers walked around him threateningly. He had been to war, and he was from the South, where a black man learned early that he had to stand up to threats or else he wasn't a man. The Baxter boys could not intimidate Bailey Johnson. Vivian's parents weren't happy that she was marrying a man from the South who was neither a doctor nor lawyer. He said he was a dietitian. The Baxter said that meant he was just a Negro cook. Vivian and Bailey left the contentious Baxter atmosphere and moved to California, where little Bailey was born. I came along 2 years later. My parents soon proved to each other that they couldn't stay together. They were matches and gasoline. They even argued about how they were to break up. Neither wanted the responsibility of taking care of two toddlers. They separated and sent me and Bailey to my father's mother in Arkansas. I was 3, and Bailey was 5 when we arrived in stamps with identification tags on our arms and no adult supervision. Save for one horrific visit to St. Louis, we lived with Grandmother Annie Henderson in stamps until I was 13. The visit to St. Louis lasted only a short time, but I was raped there, and the rapist had been killed. I thought I'd caused his death because I told his name to the family. Out of guilt, I stopped talking to everyone except Bailey. I decided that my voice was so powerful that it could kill people, but it couldn't harm my brother because we loved each other so much. My mother and her family soon wearied of the sullen, silent child and sent us back to Grandmother Henderson, in whose care we lived quietly and smoothly until my brilliant brother Bailey was 14. He'd reached a dangerous age for a black boy in the segregated South. It was at a time when if a white person walked down the one paved block in town, any Negro on the street had to step aside and walk in the gutter. Bailey would obey the unspoken order, but sometimes he would sweep his arm theatrically and loudly and say, "Yes, sir, you are the boss, boss." Grandmother warned him, "Don't you know these white folks will kill you for poking fun of them?" "Mama," my brother replied, "all I do is get off the street they are walking on. That's what they want, isn't it?" "Junior, don't play smart with me. I knew the time would come when you'd grow too old for the South. I just didn't expect it so soon. I'll write to your mother and daddy. You and Maya will have to go back to California, and soon." I knew Bailey wanted to be reunited with his mother, but I was very comfortable with Grandmother Henderson. I loved her and I liked her, and I felt safe under the umbrella of her love. But I knew that for Bailey's sake, we had to go back to California. Black boys his age who even noticed white girls risk being beaten, bruised, or lynched by the Ku Klux Klan, and as he was growing into his manhood, seeing a pretty white girl and being moved by her beauty was inevitable. I said, "Yes, I'm ready to go." My grandmother said she and I would go to California first. Bailey would follow a month later. On the train, my grandmother noticed I was frightened at the thought of meeting my mother at last. She took my hands. "Sister, there's nothing to be scared for. She is your mother, that's all. We are not surprising her. She invited us to come." Grandmother rocked me in her arms, and I calmed down. When we descended the train steps, I looked for someone who could be my mother. When I heard my grandmother's voice call out, I followed the voice, and I knew she'd made a mistake. But the pretty little woman with red lips and high heels came running to her. "Mother Annie! Mother Annie!" Grandmother opened her arms and embraced the woman. When her arms fell, the woman asked, "Where is my baby?" She looked around and saw me. I wanted to sink into the ground. I wasn't pretty or even cute. That woman who looked like a movie star deserved a better-looking daughter than me. I knew it and was sure she'd know it as soon as she saw me. "Maya? Marguerite? My baby!" Suddenly, I was wrapped in her arms and in her perfume. She pushed away and looked at me. "Oh, baby, you're beautiful and so tall. You look like your daddy and me. I'm so glad to see you." She kissed me. I hadn't received one kiss in all the years in Arkansas. Often my grandmother would call me and show me off to her visitors. "This is my grandbaby." She would stroke me and smile. That was the closest I had come to being kissed. Now, Vivian Baxter was kissing my cheeks and my lips and my hands. Since I didn't know what to do, I did nothing. Her home, which was a boarding house, was filled with heavy and very uncomfortable furniture. Sometimes she would play jazz and blues very loudly on her record player and dance just because she felt like it, alone, by herself, in the middle of the floor. While Grandmother accepted behavior so different, I just couldn't get used to it. My grandmother stayed watching me and everything that happened around me, and when she decided that everything was all right, she began to talk about going home. I was afraid to let her leave me. My mother watched me, too, without saying much. Then, after about 2 weeks, we had what was to become familiar as a sit-down talk to. She said, "Maya, you disapprove of me because I'm not like your grandmother. That's true, I am not. But I am your mother, and I am working some part of my anatomy off to pay for this roof over your head. When you go to school, the teacher will smile at you, and you'll smile back. Students you don't even know will smile, and you'll smile. But on the other hand, I am your mother. If you can force a smile on your face for a stranger, do it for me. I promise I'll appreciate it." She put her hand on my cheek. "Come on, baby. Smile for mother. Come on, be charitable." She made a funny face, and against my will, I smiled. She kissed me on my lips and started to cry. "That's the first time I've seen you smile. It's a beautiful smile. Mother's beautiful daughter can smile." I wasn't used to being called beautiful. That day, I learned that I could be a giver simply by bringing a smile to another person. The ensuing years have taught me that a kind word or a vote of support can be a charitable gift. I may never be known as a philanthropist, but I certainly want to be known as charitable. I was beginning to appreciate her. I liked to hear her laugh because I noticed that she never laughed at anyone. After a few weeks, it became clear that I wasn't using any title when I spoke to her. In fact, I rarely started conversation, most often simply responding when spoken to. She asked me into her room. She sat on her bed and didn't invite me to join her. "Maya, I am your mother, despite the fact that I left you for years. You know that, don't you?" I said, "Yes, ma'am." "You don't have to say ma'am to me. You're not in Arkansas." "No, ma'am. No. You don't want to call me mother, do you?" I remained silent. "You have to call me something. What would you like to call me?" I'd been thinking of that since I first saw her. I said, "Lady." "Why?" "Because you are beautiful, and you don't look like a mother." "Is Lady a person you like?" I didn't answer. "Is Lady a person you might learn to like?" I thought about it.
"Yes."
"Well, that's it. I am Lady, and still your mother."
Adjo Ando has been reading Mom and Me and Mom by Maya Angelou. The programme was abridged and produced by Jane Marshall Productions.
Those who know him love him. Those who don't know him are mystified and somewhat daunted by his writing.
Sir Walter Scott.
He gives us one of the very first depictions of a noble Muslim.
A superstar in his day.
More than 80 operas were written based on Scott's works.
But largely neglected by modern readers.
People telling me that they know that Scott produced certain types of images of Scotland. And then you ask them what they've actually read, and they say, "Well, I haven't actually read any."
The relevance of Walter Scott today in The Man Who Made Scotland on BBC Radio 4, this Wednesday morning at 9 o'clock.